When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome to the Green Chain Podcast. The Forest Stewardship Council was founded in 1993 by representatives from environmental groups, forest companies, the forestry profession, Aboriginal organizations, and community forestry groups from 26 countries. Since then, the FSC brand has become the label consumers and manufacturers look for to see if their wood is kosher. I met the president and CEO of the Forest Stewardship Council of Canada, Anthony Marcil, to ask the question, if a tree is certified in a forest, does anyone hear about it?
Let's start with a really basic question. What is the Forest Stewardship Council?
At a really basic level, it's a collaboration between Aboriginal people, environmentalists, labor, church groups, and economic, the private sector, to bring about the proper management of forests. It had its roots in the failure of the Rio Conference in 1992. When there was a draft forest treaty there and the governments of the world did not come to any agreement on how to protect tropical rainforests. And so there was a meeting held just a few blocks from where we're sitting here in Toronto in 1993 by civil society saying, well, if the governments of the world aren't going to protect forests, let's us do it. And so it's a real, grassroots democratic movement.
Now, I thought this was an international organization. Was it founded in Toronto?
The founding meeting was held in Toronto, yes.
Who was there?
Oh, James Sullivan and Richard Donovan and Tim Gray and all kinds of people. I wasn't anywhere near the place.
But I gather it was like church groups and environmental
groups.
Church
groups and industry groups. There was from Seven Islands, a timber company in Maine. The owner was there. So there were a number of logging companies there and labor and church groups and environmentalists. And it was all people who had a concern about the direction of forestry. And as I say, originally their focus was on tropical forests, but it very quickly became all forests.
Now, how did FSC spread out around the world? Because I know that it's now a global...
Well, I mean, it was from the beginning. It wasn't just Canadians who gathered there. It was, it was a collection of people who had been at the Rio Conference, promoting this forestry treaty that failed, and that gathered here in Toronto. So, there were Europeans and Latin Americans and a whole bunch of people here. And I'm not sure whether it was at the first meeting or a subsequent meeting, they decided that they would have the international headquarters in Oaxaca in Mexico, in the forest, in the south nominally, geographically in North America, but Mexico is still considered very much a southern country in that sense. And so the headquarters was in Oaxaca, and in fact the annual general meeting of members in 2002 was held in Oaxaca. But then between 2002 and 2005, there were financial difficulties. There were the added expenses of traveling to and from Oaxaca from all over the world, on the one hand. And on the other hand, Klaus Töpfer, who had the mandate to move the West German government to Berlin at unification, was faced with all these empty offices in Bonn. And so he decided to make Bonn, or try to make it, the environmental capital of the world. And so he went around literally courting movements around the world to get them to move to Bonn. And so he came knocking on FSC's door and offered 25 years of free rent and tenants' improvements and moving expenses. And FSC said, okay, here we come.
Moving expenses from Mexico to Germany.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
He had a mandate to fill all those empty buildings in Bonn. I used to joke with him that he was the minister of empty offices. He had been their minister of environment and one of the most far-sighted environment ministers that Europe or even the world has ever had.
Now, I thought at one point you were associated with World Wildlife.
World Environment Center.
Okay.
Yeah. I spent 15 years with the World Environment Center, which was headquartered in New York at the time. It's since moved to Washington, but it got started in New York.
And what did you do there?
What did I do there? We did environment, health, and safety in the industrial and urban context, what I used to call a brown environment, you know, as opposed to the greens and the blues, you know, land and water. World Wildlife Fund used to be primarily a green environmental now, and now they've got a big focus on marine, so they're sort of green and blue. But working in the industrial sector was unheard of for an environmental organization. And working with industry, we were just excoriated. We were sort of drummed that we weren't considered to be a valid, you know, environmental ingo, because we worked with industry, you know, back starting in 1974, which, you know, if you kind of recall, the dialogue was not with industry, it was at industry, you know, both on the part of government and NGOs. And so WEC was founded to break that mold and basically sit down and say, look, you know, if industry are causing the problem, they've got to be part of the solution. And the only way they can be part of the solution is sit down at the table with them and work with them. And that's what WEC pioneered. And now, of course, you know, every major NGO has corporate programs.
Do you face that same issue with FSC, or did FSC face that same issue originally as well?
I would guess so. There are vestiges of it still today. There are, you know, FSC, as I said, is a democratic movement. It's a membership group, and there are members within FSC who would like to see the standards written in a way to exclude industrial scale forestry operations. Who would like, and there are other members of, even though the purpose of FSC is to create standards to manage forestry, there are individual members within FSC whose purpose would be to stop all logging. And of course, if you stopped all logging, then you wouldn't need standards. So it's a bit of a contradiction in terms.
Now, I'm not sure if you brokered it or who brokered it, but the deal with the Government of Ontario for FSC certified.
Success has many parents.
Okay.
Our ore was in, but many other ores as well, and I wouldn't be able to tell you if one ore counted more than any other.
Is that the biggest triumph for FSC Canada, and can you explain it so that people know what I'm talking about?
The Government of Ontario, on the 5th of September, I believe, came out with a paper procurement announcement. In that announcement, they said that if they're reelected, of course, in 2008, if you were to look at the total paper buy of the Government of Ontario and the proportion within that of virgin fiber, that of the total amount of virgin fiber, 30% of it would be from FSC-certified forests in 2008. That's their initial goal. And they also have a goal to increase the proportion of recycled paper that they use to 50% of total paper consumption by 2012. So that was the essence of the announcement, and very significant in that they are not the first jurisdiction to announce a preference for FSC. I think provincially in Canada, Alberta was a couple of years ago. But they are the first jurisdiction to put such specific measurable goals on.
What are the FSC's biggest triumphs?
Biggest?
Triumphs.
Triumphs?
Yeah.
Surviving, you know, when you get a room full of disparate people, and you know, in that first room, you know, when people came together, there would have been people whose goal was to stop all logging, just as there were industrial loggers there whose goal was to keep on logging, and to get, you know, opinions as divergent as that to actually come together and agree on standards and principles to govern logging is an incredible accomplishment. And I think mainstream logging industry expected the whole thing to sink under its own weight, and probably it should have, but it didn't. And the result is, you know, that we've got standards that are respected worldwide, that are in force, and actually there are over 80 million hectares, that's 200 million acres of forest land around the world, certified to FSC standards by independent auditors, just like independent financial auditors, they're independent forest auditors. So the triumph is to have gone from 1993 to today and still be in business and have a growing bank of forest certified. And more important is to have marketplace recognition, and that's there now. I mean, all the major banks in Canada, the seven major banks in Canada, all use FSE paper at one level or another. And more companies are coming on board all the time. Companies know what it's about.
Now, how does somebody get certified? How is a forest certified? How is a company certified?
Well, the starting point is to have a set of standards, which FSC does not write the standards. FSC manages the process by which stakeholders write the standards. And our job is to make sure that all the stakeholders are represented around the table. So the first step is to have Aboriginal people, environmentalists, labor, other civil society groups, and industry sit around a table and decide on what the and write the standards, basically. Now, we have up on the wall the 10 principles that govern in every standard around the world. And the task of that working group around the table, all those disparate interests, is to keep looking at those 10 principles that are on the wall. And as they write the prescriptions for how forestry should be done in one of our four forest types, is that they make sure that they respect those 10 principles. Once those standards are written, they're submitted to the accreditation arm of FSC in Bonn, where technical people go over them and actually make sure that they do properly respect the 10 principles. And for the 10 principles, there are criteria. There are 57 criteria as to what it would take to satisfy each of those principles. And then there are indicators in terms of how you measure whether the criteria are being satisfied. So that's a complex, rather technical that's what's behind FSC, because if we didn't have those standards, we wouldn't be in business. Once the standards are in place, then our job is to get forestry people who own or manage forests, whether they're small or large, to voluntarily agree to adopt the FSC standard as their rule for cutting. And so we have, as I say, four standards in Canada: British Columbia, the boreal, which goes from coast to coast. We have the Great Lakes St. Lawrence, which is not quite finished, and the maritime standard. Those are the four basic forest types. We have a couple of hundred certificates in place for those are forest management certificates. So the standards are in place, and Tembec, for example, was the first major forestry company to undertake voluntarily in 2001 to have all its forests audited. So what they would do, just like hiring a financial auditor, they would ask for quotes from auditors who are accredited by FSC. There are five of them who work in Canada. And they would get quotes, and they would then choose an auditor, and the audit would take place. The job of the auditors is to go in and actually verify on the ground, in the field, and in the records in the offices to see whether or not Tembec's performance measures up to the requirements of the boreal standard, for example. Once that's done and the certificate is issued, Tembec then has trees that it is logging each year that are FSC certified and can have a logo on them. And those trees will either go to a sawmill or to a pulp mill or to some other uses. And we have what we call, and FSC established what we call a chain of custody. And the chain of custody is simply a verification that you track that when an FSC label shows up on a ream of paper that you or I buy in Staples, how do we know that the fiber that's in the paper in that ream actually came from a well-managed forest? And the answer is that the logo on that package has a number on it, and that number is a certification number of whoever made that ream of paper. And you can call them up and say, can you show us the documentation as to where you got the fiber that you used to make the paper that's in this thing? And they would have to then say, oh yeah, we bought it from so-and-so, pulp mill, and their certification number. So, and you could actually trace it all the way back to the forest.
Okay. Now, I gather some of the FSC's toughest negotiations even globally, our toughest negotiations globally, were in BC. Mm-hmm. Were you... I know that you're new to the organization, but were you aware of what some of the issues were in BC and what made BC unique for FSC certification?
BC is unique, maybe not the right word, but because we had similar difficulties, interestingly enough, at both ends of the country, in the Maritimes and in British Columbia, quite similar in nature. You had very strong environmental movements who, if you like, took a more aggressive role for themselves in the process of writing those standards, so that they had more of them ready to spend the time to be involved in the process, willing to go to more meetings, willing to sort of drag out the process as long as they could to fight for every inch of what they wanted in the standards. And as a consequence, the standards that were written, the original standards that were written in British Columbia and the Maritimes, which have both since been revised, were difficult. Difficult in that they were very demanding, they were very prescriptive, they were longer than they needed to be. And built into the FSE system is a 5-year life of any certificate or standard. So every 5 years, we convene representatives again of all the stakeholders and sit down and look at the existing standard and say, you know, are there any elements in the standard that aren't working? And all the stakeholders have opportunities to put whatever their concerns are on the table. And what we have taken a fairly active role, which some members disagree with, but in if you like, in encouraging, in stewarding the streamlining of the standards. Basically, our screen is to look at a standard and say, if there's any clause in there that does not contribute to the well-being of the forest, get it out of there. You know, there's no point having language in there that causes people to fill out forms and jump through hoops and add to cost if it doesn't result in a better situation in the forest. And so the revisions of the BC standard, which were accredited in November of 2005, went a long way to streamlining the original standard, not to watering down in any way, and in fact, in many ways, strengthening, because when you make it clearer as to what it is that you know, the performance you expect, then it's easier for the auditors to audit, and they then have less leeway in terms of what they allow, the clearer it is. So as I said, that was accredited in 2005. The Maritime Standard revisions, which were a long and difficult process, have been submitted for accreditation. We're expecting, you know, to get those back from Bonn accredited, and then the Maritime Standard will be simpler and easier to apply and more cost-effective.
Now, what is the history of the other groups that have come up to certify for us? Was FSC the original one? Are the other groups more industry based? What's
The FSC was the launch pad, if you like. The concept was launched, you know, with FSC. The initial reaction of industry, big industry anyway, was just sort of a bemusement, expecting this group of rabble-rousers and others to sink under its own weight, you know, as it might well have done. A year later, it hadn't sunk under its own weight, and it was still, you know, moving forward with defining the principles and everything. And a couple of major trade associations, one based in Canada and one based in the States, and, you know, I have no idea what their actual motivation was, but the outcome was that they each created standards. The American AF&PA actually hired people within their own staff, and they sat down and wrote standards that did not require third-party certification auditing. The Canadian Trade Association was a bit more subtle than that, and they hired the services of the Canadian Standards Association, who've been, you know, a very reputable organization, been in business for a long, long time, writing safety standards around electricity, around plumbing, around, you know, all kinds of things. And they got hired to write a forestry standard, which they did.
How big a deal was it for the FSC when J.K. Rowling announced that Harry Potter was going to come on an FSC paper?
It was a big deal, and it was a big deal for the very crass reason, if you like, that it was a big quantity of paper on the one hand, and at the same time, it was the kind of thing that might garner some media attention because, you know, as you well know, good news doesn't play well in the media. And FSC, the whole notion of forest certification, has not had a lot of media coverage. and therefore, you know, an announcement of that nature, or like the Ontario government, is very good.
Okay. It's just, that struck me as just a phenomenal PR hit for FSC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the broad sense, in the public sense, it was. In Canada, we have had in place a strategy since I joined in March of 2005 to target business-to-business, partly because certainly on the paper side, there wasn't enough product out in the marketplace that if we were to do a general PR campaign, such as in the general media, like the Potter announcement, there was very little that you and I could do in response to that announcement. You know, we read the story and say, oh, that's wonderful, you know, I'm going to do my bit, and you wouldn't be able to find anything. Whereas business could find anything, because they're at the wholesale and the business level, there's lots of product available. So that's what we've been doing, is creating buzz in the business-to-business, and feeling that would give time for more product to be available to at the retail level. And today there is, you know, the Home Depot and Lowe's and Rona and retailers, you can find a fair, IKEA, you can find a fair amount of product with FSC label on it. And you can go into Staples or the printing house and buy reams of paper that have FSC labels on them.
So this is very much something that an ordinary consumer, I could go out and go, hey, I'm going to make a choice. I'm going to build my house with FSC wood. I'm going to print this story out on FSC paper.
Yes, and that's it's uneven yet, you know, in terms of in some parts of the country you'd have a hard time finding product. In other parts, you know, everything that you need, from dimension lumber to MDF and plywood and other kinds of panel material and so on, all of it exists. It's just not easily available in all parts of the country yet, but that's changing rather rapidly. Tembec is one of the major producers and major providers to the Home Depot. As of June of this year, Tembec stamps every piece of what we call appearance grade dimension lumber that gets sent to Home Depot has got an FSC logo on it. So you will start. It's been in Home Depot for a long time, but it wasn't marked. You know, you couldn't tell that this wood was different than the piece next to it.
Where does Canada stand globally in terms of honoring forest standards?
Honoring forest standards.
In terms of what you're doing, in terms of what FSC
is. In terms of FSC, we're the leaders. We have the largest amount of certified forest. We have 22 million hectares. The next largest country behind us is Sweden with 12 million. We expect to have 30 million hectares certified by the middle of next year, and from there it'll be a matter of convincing companies that chose one of the industry standards to switch to FSC.
It's funny, I was thinking about this today, you know, going to high school in BC, we'd always talk about the forest as a renewable resource, and I wonder with what we know now, with what we're seeing now, and with the value of old growth versus the value of tree farms, is forestry really a renewable resource in the way that I would have understood it as a kid?
Mm-hmm. It's you touch on a point that's actually a sore point with us, and that is the liberal use of the word sustainable by the industry standards. You know, both the American-based and the Canadian industry-based standards call themselves sustainable. Sustainable Forestry Initiative in the U.S. and the National Sustainable Forestry Management Program here in Canada. Our response to that is, and we don't use the word sustainable unless it slips in by accident, but if you look at our materials, you won't see it, and that's because we won't know. Our kids may know whether or not forests that were FSC certified were in fact sustainable, in the sense that the ecosystems have survived intact. There are a lot of people who believe that you can't do any logging in a forest and have the ecosystem survive intact. In 50 to 100 years from now, we'll know whether the FSC standards have resulted in sustainable forests in that intact sense. But I have no doubt that certification that takes place under many systems, or because there are many systems around the world, is you know, it's inappropriate to use the word sustainable. You know. You see, for example, a lot of advertising being done by logging companies in the States that are certified to a different standard than ours, to the general public, saying forestry is in good shape because there are more forests. You know, every year the acreage of forests in the U.S. is growing. Well, sure, you can have more tree canopy when you look down from an airplane, but that doesn't mean that there's anything alive under the canopy other than trees. And to me, that's not a forest. So it's not an issue of what percentage of the country is covered with trees. It's certainly not a question of how many trees. You know, there are other companies that advertise, we planted 2 million trees last year. Well, so what? You know, the fact that one planted 2 million trees says nothing about whether or not the result of that is a healthy forest.
Can you tell me how you came to the FSC and a bit about your background?
I was what environmentalists call a generator for 22 years. I worked in industry. I left industry in 1985 to join the World Environment Center, and that was my going over to the other side, if you like. But in fact, at the World Environment Center, we proved that there isn't any other side. You know, it's just like there isn't any away when it comes to waste. You know, there's no away to take waste. It's a pipe dream that there is. And working at the World Environment Center for those 15 years was very much focused on working with industry to help them become more effective and more efficient in their use of natural resources and raw materials. We came at it from a cost accounting point of view. We documented in hundreds and hundreds of cases that if industry were to track and value its waste, it would then start managing and reducing its waste, because pollution is not free, right? Any pollution that you see, whether it's in air or on land or in water, is a raw material that somebody actually bought and paid for, and did not manage to convert to saleable material, right? It's what we call leakage. And so if you minimize, you know, the ambition of every company should be that every scrap of every ounce that they buy, you know, and every kilowatt that they buy should all get converted into a product that they sell, and then there would be no waste and no pollution, and, you know, that would be, if you like, the ultimate environmental protection. But instead of coming at it from the point of view of the goal here is to protect the environment, you come at it from the view of the goal is to convert everything we buy into dollars. Then it's a lot more attractive to industry. After doing that, it's cost effective to do so. I didn't find a single industry sector in which it wasn't cost effective to do, you know, to work this way. But the problem was that we were documenting all these case studies, and the voluntary take up on the part of industry that we didn't visit was about zero. And even some companies would take this up and they would champion how much money they were saving, and then a new CEO would come along and he'd say, oh, no, that's not core business, stop doing that. So it didn't stick, it had no sticking power. Which left me to actually leave the World Environment Center and spend a period of 5 years working on tax reform, because I had come to the conclusion that one of the major reasons that industry was not voluntarily taking up the epiphany wasn't sticking was that there are too many signals around us. You know, we're all logical. Nobody gets up in the morning and says, you know, my ambition today is to pollute the Ottawa River, or, you know. I mean, their ambition is to make money, and you pay attention to the signals that drive, you know, that are important to you in doing that. And our tax codes around the world are critical in that area. There are many, many taxes in Canada that are completely contrary to stated public policy of having clean air and healthier people and healthy forests, such as car parking lots that provided by employers are a taxable benefit to the employee. Are a free good to the employee. If the employer gives a transit pass, it's a taxable benefit. until the Harper government, you know, has changed that now. There are, the GST is rebated to builders who buy farmers' fields and rezone them and build, you know, single-family units. There's a GST rebate. But if you buy an old house, you know, in the middle of a city and renovate it, there's no GST rebate on the materials. So the tax system subsidizes sprawl and penalizes redevelopment. And, you know, I participated in a study done by the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy about 4 years ago, I guess, in which there were well over 100 illustrations of taxes of, you know, this nature that needed to be changed. So I spent 5 years working on that and didn't get anywhere. You know, the tax code is jealously guarded by the mid-level mandarins in the Ministry of Finance, and they don't want anyone to change anything anyway. So, and the politicians don't get it. You know, they'll tell you in public meetings that they do, but in terms of action, they don't actually do anything. Although, as I said, that move that Harper made when he first came into power to make a transit passes that you and I buy partially tax deductible is the first step in that direction of recognizing. And BC has been a leader in thinking about this, and they call it tax shifting in BC. And there's been a pretty strong tax shifting movement in BC for many years now. But so it's well documented as what all the opportunities are to make these kinds of changes, but the actual changes are very few and far between. So after spending 5 years in, you know, very frustrating, not, you know, when you don't deliver any accomplishments, it was rather easy decision when the offer came to join FSC and take it from the standards writing phase out into the marketplace and make FSC a success in the marketplace. You know, it was an easy decision.
If somebody came to you tomorrow and said, "Hi, do you want to run? You know, hi, we're putting you in charge of Canvas for us." What would you do?
Run the other way. in charge of Canada's full. It depends what you see. In the classic way of thinking, you know, whoever is, you know, to be the Minister of Forestry, you're not in charge of Canada's forests. If they came along and said, "We're going to make you Minister of Finance," well, I'd be there in a nanosecond, because then I would be in charge of Canada's forests. The Minister of Environment, the Minister of Natural Resources, the Ministry of Forestry, they're not in charge of Canada's forests. They're in charge of exploiting them. They're not in charge of maintaining them.
So what could you do as Minister of Environment?
Nothing.
Okay.
I think ministries of environment should be abolished. They're a crutch. They're something that allow the general public to feel that, oh yeah, you know, we've handed that responsibility over to somebody there in charge, so I don't have to worry about it now, which is a total crock. The ministers of environment are not. The people who can influence the environment are the ministers of industry, minister of trade, minister of agriculture, minister of public works. Those are the guys who have an impact on the environment, not the ministries of environment.
So what would you like to see done?
Abolish the ministries of environment, make the responsibility for the condition of the environment a line responsibility in all the line ministries, and put the Minister of Finance in charge.
Okay. How do you feel about trees?
We couldn't live without them. You look back at all the societies that have become extinct, you know, you find for the most part it's because they changed the condition of the land that wouldn't support growth of vegetation anymore. And therefore, they lost their water supply.
Cool. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Anthony Marceau from the Forest Stewardship Council of Canada. For the Green Chain Podcast, I'm Mark Larignan.